I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. And now for the part of the show we call Lanya. That's Creole for something extra. You've probably already seen NBA players dazzle on the basketball court, and you probably know that some occupy spots on those lists of most wealthy Americans. But maybe you don't know that these champion dunkers and dribblers also dominate the fashion pages and the runway. Here's NBA Hall of Famer Charles Barkley judging the 2015 All-Star All-Style NBA fashion show, commenting on the outfit of the Cleveland Cavaliers' J.R. Smith.
I think you look fantastic. I think the green is a very nice touch. I think the little skunk is a nice touch. But you look great, man.
Author Mitchell S. Jackson has captured the NBA fashion evolution in his book, Fly, The Big Book of Basketball Fashion. Mitchell is a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine and is the first Black columnist at Esquire, where he writes about race and culture. He won the 2021 Pulitzer Prize for magazine feature writing and is a distinguished professor in the English department at Arizona State University. And Mitchell S. Jackson joins me now from Phoenix. Welcome to Under the Radar, Mitchell.
Thank you for having me.
Well, your book is so fun, and it's big, as it's promised in the title. It is big. Yeah. It looks like a coffee table book so that we can see the fashions better. One of those early pages, big old full page of LeBron James in all of his glory, his fashion glory. So you know what you're getting when you start reading the book.
Yeah, definitely. Had to start with Bron because he's, you know, King James, and also he's one of the pioneers of this era of NBA fashion.
This is true. Now, when did you realize that nobody had written about this before? Because I learned a lot while reading the book, including the fact that there was an NBA fashion show. But so when did it all come together for you that nobody had written about all this?
Well, I wish I could claim the credit for this, but it was actually my editor at Hearst or Esquire. Brought it to me, knowing that I'm a former junior college basketball player and that I love fashion. And once he brought it to me, it just really made sense. Like I pay attention to what was happening in the league, maybe more so after the book, but certainly before that. And I just realized that we were really in a moment where NBA fashion was in the zeitgeist. And once I started doing a little research and realized that no one else had written about this in a book form, it made sense to try to do it and be first.
So your book, again, the Fly, the Big Book of Basketball Fashion, is broken down in errors. So error one is the conformist that starts in 1946, goes on to 1963. Then error two is flamboyance. Error three is just Jordan. We know that's Michael Jordan. Error four is the Iverson effect, as in Allen Iverson. Error five is the dress code. And then error six is 2016 and beyond. So you made these sort of boundaries in these years. Why? Why did you think that was the best way to explain what was happening in this evolution?
Initially, I was going to do it by decades. And I think I had the influence of the NBA at 75 and the NBA at 50. I don't know if you remember when they commemorated the 50 greatest players ever, and then they just recently did 75. And I thought, oh, decades make sense. And then talking with my editor, and thank God for great editors, he was like, well, decades are actually kind of arbitrary. They don't really tell us anything about the culture. And so I was like, yeah, you're right. So then we started thinking about errors. And once I started thinking about eras, I was like, okay, where do we delineate these different eras? What are the watershed moments in NBA history or NBA fashion? And you couldn't talk about watershed moments in NBA fashion without talking about cultural, political, other kind of forces that kind of brought those moments into being. So it took looking at a lot of pictures and seeing where the fashion changed dramatically, and then asking myself, what was happening in the world that might have produced those results.
So how did we, or they, get from the conformists in 1946, which I want you to explain, all the way to 2016 and beyond and everything that happened in between? I mean, there's huge things happening in those eras, as you explain. But just broadly, how did you get from, you know, one end to the other?
If you look at the eras of NBA fashion, they really follow politically what was happening to Black people. So if we think about 46, that's, you know, right after World War II, but that's also pre-civil rights. And the reason why people are conforming is because Black men are not considered full citizens yet. Like, we still can't vote in places. And, you know, there's still Jim Crow going on. And so there's a lot of pressure to conform. If you think about what happens after the Voting Rights Act, Black people, you know, we get Black power movement, we get Blaxploitation, we get Blacks enjoying this newfound pseudo freedom, and it really shows up in the clothes and the bell bottoms and the turtlenecks and the tassels and the afros. And then, you know, we get the 1980s with Reagan and the way that, you know, capitalism was shaping American politics in the 80s. And if you follow that track all the way through, what you get to now is Black men in the NBA making more money than they ever have made, being more politically aware than they ever have been. And that kind of power, I think, is also shaping the league, right? The players are able to move different places now. You know, they talk about LeBron being late GM for his ability to control teams, and he's not the only one. So I think if you kind of track the political evolution of Black people in this country, you kind of get a blueprint for NBA fashion.
So let's have an example of, in your book, from the conformist era. Like, did you talk about somebody that is the perfect example of conformist, and what does that mean when we talk about how the person would be dressed?
Well, I mean, if you look at the NBA prior to 1950, which is when the first Black player came in, you'll see team photos of guys in dark suits with dark shoes and white shirts and ties. And so, you know, someone like a Bob Cousy or, you know, a George Mikan, that was really what the league looked like. And the Black players, there were so few of them, we didn't get the first Black players till 1950, that, you know, it's a rarity that you get to the league. So why would you want to come in there disturbing the aesthetics of what was happening? So those early players, you look at Bill Russell, you know, you see Bill Russell, he's in a suit. He got his, you know, hair cut short. So I think, you know, Bill Russell is probably a really good example of what the league looked like and what the players were, not necessarily forced, but coerced into looking like.
And then when we talk about flamboyance, give people a sense of what you mean when you say flamboyance, because you could pick any one of these eras except for conformists and say maybe it's a little flamboyant.
Yeah, but there's I think the greatest shift is from the era of conformity to the era of flamboyance. So yeah, after that you could say that, but it wouldn't be such a great shift. I think you got to talk about Walt Frazier in the era of flamboyance. He was like the style king of that era, even though I actually favor Dr. J. But if you look at both of those guys, even Will Chamberlain, there's, you know, Will Chamberlain's on there with his shirt unbuttoned to his navel, and he got, you know, butterfly collar shirt on, and he got flared pants. You look at Walt with his cape on and his fedora. You look at Dr. J. There's a picture of him out near the Coliseum in New Jersey with the all white on. He got the Casio gold watch and the big afro, and his shades are matching the burgundy in his shoes. Like, those guys to me were really representative of the flamboyance of that era.
And would you say that they then brought with them some of the Black cultural expressions that had really not been seen before? Like, you know, you can be flamboyant in all kinds of ways, but this was a particular kind of flamboyance that was connected to Black culture.
Absolutely. There's a picture of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar And he's wearing a dashiki with his afro, and I don't, you can't get much more black than wearing a dashiki.
I would say that's true. Now I want to make the pivotal point, because what you've done so well with by dividing this these players into these eras is really honing in on those significant pivotal points, as you've said. And one of the biggest was the influence of the 90s and hip hop specifically. So talk about that.
There's the Iverson effect, and really, I mean, I could have very well called it the hip hop effect. I think Iverson, he and I are the same age. We're just a few months apart. And Iverson is part of the first era of NBA players that actually can't remember a time when hip hop didn't exist, right? So hip hop is born in the early to mid 70s. Iverson is born in 75. So they come into the NBA as the children of hip hop, and they are hip hop. It's not like they are assuming a cultural moment that they are not a part of. And so if you look back at what was happening in rap music, that's what Iverson was. You know, the baggy clothes, the braids, the headbands, the gaudy jewelry, which was really, you know, hip hop came out of the struggle. And once they got a little bit of money, they started being very ostentatious in the way, a lot of them started being ostentatious in the way that they showed it. And that was that era. You know, look at Rip Hamilton, Jermaine O'Neal, Allen Iverson, you know, later on, Carmelo Anthony. All those guys are really running concomitant with the hip hop era. And guys like Jay-Z and, you know, Diddy, when he was doing, you know, when Jay-Z was having a party, Big Pimpin' on the Boat, and Diddy was in the bathtub with champagne, and all those guys were really about excess. That really shows up in that hip hop era.
Here's Jermaine Dupri's Money Ain't a Thing featuring
Yeah.
Jay-Z. Here we go.
Even me and Jay-Z got it locked crazy. Ferrari and Jaguar switching four lanes. Top down, screaming out, money ain't a thing.
Bubble hard in the double law, flashing the rings with the window crack, holler back, money ain't a thing.
Hate it telling.
So got you singing there, Mitchell.
That's right. I can remember that video well. They were throwing money out of the roof of a Ferrari.
So that's just to say that here we had the hip hop influence and folks had money. And
Yeah.
now, as has been demonstrated in another book, I interviewed this author not long ago, Soumya Krishnamurthy. She's written a book
Oh,
called
yeah.
Fashion Killer: How Hip Hop
Yep.
Revolutionized High Fashion. So this is
Yeah.
overlapping now. Here's the NBA players looking, being influenced by the hip hoppers. The hip hoppers are moving into high fashion, and everybody's got money, and all this thing is happening together. And it seems cool. And then all of a sudden, the NBA says, well, not so much. We're going to impose a dress code. Which
Yeah.
did not sit well with Allen Iverson, of whom we were just speaking. So here he is talking on All the Smoke about NBA fashion and the dress code.
How you gonna tell me what to wear to go to work? You know what I mean? When you know, I can understand if you're a lawyer or something like that, you ain't come to court with a sweatsuit on. You know what I mean? I understand that, but man, I'm coming to play basketball. I'm coming to be comfortable. I'm coming to get ready, and I want to be cool.
So they imposed this dress code, and what happened?
And initially, they had people like Iverson and Carmelo Anthony and Rip Hamilton protesting in very explicit ways and also implicit ways, and they were catching the fines. And then David Stern kind of won out, and the guy started dressing up. Even Iverson started wearing big sport coats and with his jeans and, you know, a little less jewelry. And it really changed the culture of the NBA. There was a lot of resistance at first, and I think the guys really leaned into it afterwards. And we're really talking about the youngsters that come in the league at that time, which is Dwayne Wade, LeBron James, Chris Bosh, Chris Paul. Like, those are the guys that started to embrace the new standards or mandates of the NBA fashion.
If you're just tuning in, this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley, and my guest is Mitchell S. Jackson, author of Fly, the Big Book of Basketball Fashion. We're talking about basketball players who are fashion forward. And so now we're really talking about high fashion. By that we mean, you know, houses of haute couture that people recognize. Samia told me when we were talking about her book is that the rappers were not initially accepted in that space, even though they had the money and the interest. But it seems to me from what I read in your book that that was a little bit different for the NBA players, or did I read that wrong? What would you say?
I think initially the rappers also weren't accepted, because if you look back at hip hop fashion, and even NBA players, they were wearing Pele Pele. They were wearing Sean John. They were wearing Rockaware. If you look at Iverson, he was wearing Fat Farm, like black designers initially is what they were wearing. And then really I give credit to Jay-Z and Puffy, who started talking about, there was a song Jay-Z had called Change Clothes, you know, throw on a suit and get it tapered up. And he had French cuff shirts. And I really think they started to wear the European designers before the European designers actually embraced them. And once they realized that, you know, what's a better advertisement than Jay-Z saying your brand on his record and that becoming a platinum hit? I think they saw the economic power of hip hop and the influence of hip hop, and they kind of acquiesced. But still, there's a contentious relationship between black people and hip hop and those major brands, or those European brands. I mean, every year, they do something racist, whether it was Gucci or Balenciaga.
Yeah.
Right. So there's always, and I think there will remain that, because so much of those brands is built on European history, which is essentially antagonistic in a lot of ways to black culture.
Mm-hmm. But here we are now, where the tunnel walk, if people are not familiar, that's the walk going into the sports arenas. It used to be folk just walked, but now everybody's looking at it as a runway to see what everybody has on. And I have to say, people listening to me, my listeners know, I know very little about sports and don't care. But one of the things that jumped out at me that is still resonant and is a pivotal point in your book is when LeBron James wore a suit with shorts. Now, here is Global News talking about that moment.
So that is LeBron James wearing a suit, but with shorts and high ankle socks.
The socks are throwing me a little bit. It's not so much the shorts with the suit. And there he is last night coming in for game two. He has switched it up a little bit and went with the Red Sox. You don't play for Boston, LeBron. You play for Cleveland. Boston's the Red Sox. But I don't know. I don't know if I would do this look personally, but I think LeBron can get away with it.
I would say, right?
Yeah. I mean, you sports guys talking fashion. I remember one time I went to the barbershop and I had on a really fashion forward outfit, and I came in and immediately all the barbers and the people, they were on my head. And I remember telling my barber, man, if you understood this, I wouldn't want to do it. And I kind of feel like that's the same thing with the sports talk radio guys. If they understood what was happening in the fashion, they would be fashion guys, not sports talk radio guys. LeBron was a little ahead of his time. But I also should mention that was a Tom Brown suit. So to wear that, and he also wore it with a big, you know, Tom Brown bag. He had Tom Brown combat boots on, or really wingtip boots. So that was a really fashion-forward look in a brand that was on the ascendance too. So to be able to bring that brand attention, to wear it in a way that hadn't been worn. He cut the pants into shorts. So I think Ron was really on it. And I think at that time he was working with Rachel Johnson, who was one of the very first big black stylists in the NBA.
So now we're at a point where players are at fashion shows, where they're recognized by fashion icons. They're at the Met Ball. And there's even Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who has been all over GQ, and that's a fashion magazine. Here he is reviewing his NBA draft suit for the magazine.
I was getting my draft suit ready, maybe 3 weeks before. I had a suit idea, and I went to the shop to try it on, and I saw like a fabric on the side, and it was that pattern of the draft suit. And I told him to try it just in the trim of my jacket that I already had. And then I said, let's just go all out and all over the pants. And then I tried that on, and I fell in love.
He's, you know, kind of a regular now in terms of fashion for that magazine.
Well, you know, Shade was voted most stylish man in the world 2 years running. Not most stylish NBA player, most stylish man in the world by GQ 2 years running. And because he had won it twice, he was ineligible to be in it the following year. So that just shows you how serious and how much respect the NBA players now have in the fashion world. So it is not surprising to me at all that he can talk extensively and feels very proud of his draft suit, because he really is a fashionista. He's walking in the fashion shows. I'm sure now every fashion brand is coveting him. He's sitting front row. I mean, he is a fashion icon in this moment.
And when you say front row, we're talking about front row fashion shows, both here and in Europe and, you know, around the world.
Exactly. Milan, Paris, London, all of them.
Right, exactly. So one of the other things that you make clear, and this is going back to how we began this conversation, that these errors were shaped by what was happening contextually, culturally about two black folks. What also happens and continues to happen is a lot of the racism that's still out there in the wider world and in basketball as well. But of course, we've seen some, you know, tragedies with the death of young men, and many of the NBA players led by LeBron, in many instances, used that as a moment to speak back, use the fashion to say, I'm going to wear a T-shirt that says, I can't breathe, or, you know, I am Trayvon, whatever needed to be said in the moment. Let's talk about, you know, how important that change was.
I think it's tremendous. But I also want to contextualize what LeBron is doing with the era of flamboyance. So if you think about what Kareem Abdul-Jabbar did and changing his name, and there's a photo of him with Bill Russell and Muhammad Ali at the Cleveland summit, right? A very political moment. There was also a guy named Chris Jackson, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, who was really blackballed out of the NBA for refusing to stand for the national anthem because he was Muslim. And it really shows how much the league has changed in terms of how much power the players have. I don't think we could have had this vocal of an NBA protest during the George Floyd protest if LeBron hadn't opened the door and if LeBron hadn't been the most powerful and popular player in the NBA.
So in conclusion, what would you say to the readers that you want them to take away from the Fly, the big book of basketball fashion? I also want to note you use Fly too, which is a 80s, 90s term to mean cool.
Yeah. what I want readers to take away is, one, I'm a writer first. And so, I mean, if you read the book, there's a really great attention to language in that book. And I revise that book in the same way I revise a novel or a profile. And, you know, obviously the pictures are there. The other thing is, I would say that the book is a cultural criticism, right? And thinking about what was shaping these players and the way that they were thinking and what they could and couldn't wear. Fashion, to me, is a representation of what's happening culturally and politically. So it's a fun book. You could just flip through it for the pictures. You can also, if you're a reader, I hope, appreciate the language. And then there is the history of the NBA and what was happening politically and culturally and economically that shaped what people wear and why they wear it and when they wear it.
So I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this question. There are no women, WNBA. And yet we've seen that a lot of them, the Lexi Browns, the Chelsea Grays, the DeJounte Carrington and Sue Bird and others who have made themselves fashion icons. And a lot of them are models. I mean, they've, you know, as a side thing. So why not have them as part of this book?
So that was probably the deepest editorial debate that I had with the two editors on this book. And eventually I wanted to put a section in, but the one of the issues, and this is one of their pushback, was that I did not include in WNBA fashion until the WNBA began. So we're not talking about them until era five of the NBA era. And so it, like, they argued that it would feel like a slight to women that they just came in and almost as an afterthought. And so I eventually acquiesced and saw their way, like, okay, this, if it's going to be WNBA fashion, they need to have their own book. And it needs to start with the history of the WNBA, which means it needs to, or even really before that, right? Like, what's the history of women's basketball? And so I did not have that breadth of space in the book. And so I think someone really should take that up as a project, not as part of the men's game, but actually as their own thing.
Okay, well, we'll be looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you. Really enjoyed it.
Mitchell S. Jackson is the author of Fly, the Big Book of Basketball Fashion. That's it for this week's edition of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Listen to us online at GBH News or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on X, formerly Twitter, and Facebook to stay up to date with our programming. Under the Radar with Callie Crossley is a production of GBH, produced by Jesse Steinmetz and engineered by Dave Goodman. Our intern is Tu Lee. Our theme music is Fish and Chips by We Are Two Saxies, Grace Kelly and Leo P. Listen again on Wednesday and see you here at 6 p.m. next Sunday for a new episode. I'm Callie Crossley. Thanks for listening.